Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. You're listening to America This Week.
Hello, welcome back to America This Week. I'm Kevin Clark. I'm here with Kerry Weber. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. We're talking today with Daniel Padilla Peralta. We're talking about his memoir, Undocumented, A Dominican Boy's Odyssey from a Homeless Shelter to the Ivy League. We'd love for you to give us a call to tell us what you think and to ask some questions of Daniel at 1-888-3-CATHOLIC. That's 1-888-322-8465. Daniel, thanks again for being with us today. I didn't get a chance to read your book, but I read some excerpts at the good old Penguin website.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Which I'm guessing is penguin.com, but you know, I don't know. It's in the excerpt they highlighted was a kind of an awful day, I guess, for you. Your mom was calling you at Collegiate because the police were going through your home looking for drugs because they got the apartments mixed up on a raid. And I was struck by a couple of things. First of all, something I've noticed before in different Catholic cultures. I grew up in a New York Irish Catholic, which perhaps is more reserved than other Catholic cultures. But your mother seems, in your depiction of her, seems to involve the Holy Family a lot in things that are going on in your life, which I think is just kind of a wonderful way to go about your day where you're kind of seeking help, making offerings, and bringing the Holy Family into your reality. Is that something, it was a regular occurrence for her, thanking the Virgin? And
oh, it is a regular occurrence for her. It is wired into how she negotiates her day-to-day existence. It's very much part of the fabric of her emotional and psychological life. She is exceptionally devout. She puts everyone else in the family to shame, I think, although she would never admit this.
And because right, otherwise she wouldn't be that holy.
Precisely, right. She would not rise to the standard of holiness if she boasted about it.
Yeah.
But it is very much woven into how she engages with the world.
Is she sort of the hero of your memoir? I mean, obviously, your father returned to the Dominican Republic. Your mother was left by herself to navigate a different culture and the brutal New York social welfare bureaucracy. How did she hold it all together for you through those years?
She had a tremendous vision. So one of the things that I still marvel at to this day is how she could see my brother and me and think, oh, one day they're going to accomplish these things. And she was tireless in persuading us of the need for us to accept this vision, because there were many times when both my brother and I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. And when I had plenty of frustration and anger as I entered into my early teens and beyond, I thought that we were living in these deplorable conditions. Once I entered Collegiate, I realized for the first time that people had radically different lives and they had access to all these things I could only dream of. And this at times infuriated me. But she had this vision that enabled her to be patient, to be resolved, to be trusting that things would work out in the end. And at the end of every single major crisis, she would say, oh, someday one of you two is going to write about this. And so her prophecy has come true.
Well done. No, she also taught you a lot about the Dominican Republic itself. And you write about not being able to find out a lot about that in books, in classes. I wonder if since then, you've sort of found more scholarly sources about this, things that you might recommend to others for learning about the Dominican Republic.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So one of the many realizations I had as I began to think of myself not only as a humanist, but also as a historian, is that the kinds of history we consume are shaped by these ideological forces and these currents that in many cases are not discussed explicitly. And so this was one of the many issues I wrestled with as a teenager. Well, why is it that my home country receives scant attention in historical texts, in English historical texts? So now I spend a fair bit of time thinking about the Dominican Republic for a number of reasons. One, the ongoing situation with Haitian immigrants and the descendants of Haitian migrants in the Dominican Republic. But two, I am by training and by avocation, a classicist. And I'm very interested in how the Greek and Roman world is being put to use in the Dominican Republic. And on this, there's not that much writing, but there's actually a fair bit of provocative material, ranging from histories like the histories written by Frank Moya Pons to the vast, still mostly untranslated texts on Dominican history that have been written by Dominican historiographers. And they, in many cases, provide unwittingly evidence of the degree to which the Greek and Roman past has been used against Haitians, which is something that I research as part of my professional work.
Oh, that's fascinating. And now let's talk about your role as a classicist for a minute, because I think people who study the classics often get labeled as people who perhaps are sort of, have their heads in the clouds, or it seems to be something that people study if they don't have to worry about working or getting a job. You know, if you already have rich parents who can support you when you get out of college, because, it doesn't necessarily automatically translate into job skills. But obviously, you point out so many important things that can be learned through this kind of study. I wonder if you felt it was a risk to go into studying this as something that might not translate into work, or if you just always sort of felt so passionately about it that you knew it was something you had to do.
So the first feeling that motivated me to pursue it was undoubtedly the passion. It was the slow realization in accumulating in power and significance over the years that this was so captivating to experience these texts in Greek and Latin, to think about this history of these many intersecting cultures that we designate as Greek and Roman, but were in fact remarkably diverse and prolific in the range of their cultural productions. Then I was also seized by another realization, and this has taken me the greater part of my 20s and now entering my 30s to sort out. And it is the intersection of the fabric of the academic disciplines with the construction of privilege. And so, as you mentioned, there is a sense in which classics has been, for a very long time, dominated by people who did not have financial or economic concerns, or who had minimal concerns at best. But I was recently teaching W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk to my formerly incarcerated adults, and one of the topics that came up in our discussion was Du Bois' insistence on the need for a humanistic education and his determination to fight against those who would argue that, minorities or people of color only need or should only have access to vocational and these other kinds of educations that are not humanistic. And my students really fought hard against that, and I'm determined to fight with them against that.
Do you find that your students, who obviously approach the classics from a different perspective than your average college freshman might, do they tease out things that you hadn't noticed yourself before in the texts?
Yes, they absolutely do. And one of the tasks of our course was to help them realize that by virtue of their experiences as formerly incarcerated adults, they could bring this vast amount of knowledge to bear on these texts, knowledge that they themselves were not aware of until we coaxed it out of them. So to give one example, we were reading the Odyssey, and in our second discussion of the Odyssey, our conversation turned to thinking carefully and trying to tease out some of the anxieties Odysseus might have felt about returning home. And one of the issues that we really zeroed in on was the question of whether home is stable, whether your understanding of what home is will line up with how much your home has changed. And one of my students reflected on this very powerfully by beginning to speak of his own experiences negotiating the transition back to home and the degree to which those experiences were shaped by his almost epiphanous discovery that he had wanted home to remain static, but home had so dramatically changed. And the home he had conjured up for himself and imagined for himself while he was incarcerated was, of course, nothing like the home he was returning to. And yet that was a productive experience for him because he realized that it was in that gap between his expectation of what home was and his discovery of what home really was when he returned that his life attained a new valor and a new meaning.
How has your own idea of home for you changed over the years as you've moved from place to place within the city, as you've gone to Oxford, to Stanford, Princeton, all these places?
My understanding of home has been inflected in part by my engagement with the Odyssey and other texts about travel. The Aeneid is another one that comes to mind. When I was younger, I used to think that hopping around from place to place was something to be not so much ashamed about, but to be a little anxious about. I didn't have the kind of stability that my friends had. Several of my close friends in middle school and high school had lived in the exact same apartment their whole lives. But then I slowly began to appreciate why the experience of moving around from place to place actually equipped me with a set of tools. And some of these were cognitive, others were emotional and psychological. It taught me the value of appreciating all of the differences in these places. It gave me an enhanced sensitivity to what made each place distinctive and special. And most of all, it prepared me for the contingencies and the precariousness of moving from place to place. It taught me to realize that it's going to be all right if I have to make a transition from point A to point B for a few years. Things are going to work themselves out.
Just like your mother always assured you they would work out.
No, it was hard to buy into the faith that she had, but it has worked. Her magic has worked.
Now, you also spoke, I saw in, I think, the New York Times article about you that you considered a job in Major League Baseball or in writing about baseball in a very sort of analytical way. I wonder if you see any sort of overlap in your love of baseball. Presumably you would like baseball if you were interested in working there, and your love of baseball and your love of classics, or if you saw these as sort of two separate interests in a way.
Well, if you're a Mets fan, then you're familiar with tragedy. and comedy, I guess.
Sadly, I'm a Yankees fan.
I'm from Massachusetts. We're going to shut this down now.
Really, this show must end now. I see them as these two domains of my life as complementing each other, and the kinds of expertise, the forms of knowledge one brings to them. So when I became really, really obsessed with not just baseball, but the analytics of baseball, this required the mastery of a whole new language. There was a lot of work, groundbreaking work that was being done in the early aughts to really push forward the analytics of baseball.
Right, the whole Moneyball.
The whole Moneyball phenomenon, sabermetrics, and it schools that, in order to not even to master, to at least be conversant with, required familiarizing yourself with all of these different concepts and these techniques, some of which I would profess to have very little in the way of sophisticated grasp over, like hardcore statistical mining or things like that. And so there was the allure of approaching a subject that required this whole new vocabulary, this very different set of tools for conceptualizing the world. Other than that, I would say that they are very different, and that my exposure to the classics and my exposure to baseball is only linked insofar as I really appreciate winners. But then that gets me into Trump territory, so we will stay clear of that.
I love that idea of the classics professor who moonlights as a sports writer, so I really hope that comes to fruition. That's got to be some kind of meta-American dream fully realized. And then you could go to the Dominican Republic and scout some new talent.
That's
where a lot of it comes from these days.
Pedro Martinez just got in the Baseball Hall of Fame this week.
Red
Sox. I'm mentioning a Red Sox player.
You're
just
killing
to,
me with the baseball references.
I'm just mentioning a Red Sox player just to make sure we have, you know.
Oh, that's fine. I have plenty of respect for Pedro. Pedro is the greatest pitcher I've ever seen pitch.
Yeah.
I don't think there's, for my generation, I don't think there's much of a debate on that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go home and watch 48 hours of ESPN I come back on the air here with
you
guys.
So, Danielle, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what sort of words of encouragement or advice you might give to young people who are in communities that are struggling, who are in families that are struggling, who are might be undocumented or might be just young students of color that are looking to kind of figure out what to do with their lives, figure out where to go. What advice might you give?
So I would give several bits of advice. The first is more narrowly targeted to undocumented immigrants, and then the other bits will apply, whether one is documented or undocumented. To undocumented immigrants, I would say that one of the first things that we as an undocumented community need to do, and that undocumented immigrants need to do individually, is to try to reverse the sense of self-stigmatization that frequently comes about as a result of having to navigate these ordeals associated with the lack of papeles. One of the difficulties I had growing up was my determination not to talk about being undocumented. I saw it as a source of shame. And it took me forever to realize that, in fact, my feeling of shame was something that was being engendered by this discourse that attributed this lack of papers to immigrants and read it as a deficiency that they were responsible for. So the very first bit of advice I would give to them is to think of themselves as empowered and uniquely gifted individuals. This lack of documentation problem is something that is squarely the result of U.S. immigration policy. The second bit of advice I would give them, and ties in with the first, is that when they feel comfortable and ready, they should consider advocacy. And they should consider a whole range of advocacy options, ranging from work in their local environments and their communities and their schools to work that will span across state and regional and even national lines down the road. Then to other folks in communities who are documented but still have many of the struggles I chart in the book, I would encourage them to read, to read as much and as often as they possibly can, because it was the companionship of books that was one of the first things that enabled me to see beyond my situation.
Yeah, I think the power of books cannot be underestimated. We were always sort of limited when we went out with my family to, as to, you know, like, this, you don't get something this day, you don't get books. Were always sort of like, yes, you can get books. We're going to the library as much as you want. So I second that. It opens up a whole new world. Danielle Padilla Peralta, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your book. Thanks for spending this time with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
So coming up next, we're going to be speaking with Marianne Cusmano Love about her recent article in America on peace building in the nuclear age. This is America This Week on Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.